The tax cuts will pay for themselves by stimulating economic activity and so tax collections. The tax cuts will not pay for themselves. They will only increase the deficit. Those statements are mutually exclusive, and you've probably heard them a lot over the years. Our guest certainly has, and he's been listening to both economists like himself and politicians for years. He explores the rocky relationship between those factions in the book Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Alan S. Blinder was a vice chair at the Federal Reserve Board, served on President Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, and is now professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. He is author, co-author, or co-editor of 16 previous books. Alan Blinder, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, one of those books is called Hard Heads, Soft Hearts, which, judging by what you're saying in this book, is your favorite approach.
It is my favorite approach, and I reprise it a bit in this book. You know, that book, Hard Heads, Soft Hearts, you mentioned, was written 30 years ago. And I looked at it again in doing this one. It's amazing how little has changed. I mean, the concrete issues change all the time, constantly. But the principles haven't changed that much in 30 years. That's kind of sad, because we could be doing better.
I was going to ask you if that was a source of sadness or solace. It is sadness, you're saying.
Yeah, it's sadness, I think. There are better policy options available. And you know, you just alluded to one. There may be, and there, I think there were good reasons to reform the tax code last year, but we didn't really reform the tax code. It's more complex than ever, and many people think it's more unfair than ever. That last is a judgment that's in the eye of the beholder, but nobody can really say the tax code got simpler. And nobody should ever have said, even though our Secretary of the Treasury, among others, did, that the tax cut will pay for itself because of the bountiful economic growth it will unleash. That was nonsense.
There was a Congressional Budget Office CBO scoring on the
sure.
tax cut plan, and it showed that there was not going to be a recovery, didn't it? I mean, a recovery of lost tax revenue.
Of revenue, yeah, exactly. It showed, as most analyses do, that cutting taxes should give the economy a short-term sugar high, and it will. I don't doubt that. But first of all, we don't really need a short-term sugar high. But even if you think you wanted it, you should realize that there's a long-run revenue cost to this. And in this particular instance, it's quite sizable.
All right, we'll explore sugar high and some of the things we're talking about in today's world. I want to get to some of the more fundamentals here, because when you look at economists and politicians, you're saying it's not just different thinking, but different civilizations.
I do. I mean, I don't think it sounds like too strong a term, but I think it's not too strong a term, because they speak differently, almost different languages, although we do use English sometimes. They certainly think differently, and they do arithmetic differently. That's one of the most amazing things. The political arithmetic just looks a lot different from economic arithmetic.
It seems to get into a lot of shorthand, too. I mean, politicians are prone to the phrases that will fit on bumper stickers and in 10-second sound bites, as you point out in the book. But we seem to hear great economic terms like, oh, that's just a rounding error, that sort of thing. Right. You notice that one?
Yes, we all use that one. But, you know, you're 100% right. You go all the way back to Harry Truman when he was president, complained that all the economists say on the one hand, on the other hand, and he asked for a one-handed economist.
Right.
So he wasn't the last to feel that worry. The real economy, the real world is a complicated place, and snappy, short answers or snappy, short policy, quote, remedies, unquote, are usually not really right.
So when Ronald Reagan said there are simple answers, just not easy ones, was he correct?
Not to too many questions. I don't want to say that's never true to any question, but it's very unlikely to be true to a question of significant interest in the economic realm, like what should we do about the deficit, what should we do about Social Security, how do you fix the tax code, what about international trade, and on and on and on. There are not short, snappy answers that are correct.
You do us the service of giving us your politics up front. And in the absence of Rockefeller Republicans, I do remember those. What are you?
Yeah. I'm a Democrat. I think I said in the book I might have been as a young man a Rockefeller Republican, and if there were such a thing, I might still be. But there isn't such a thing. any of those people that are alive that think that way are now Democrats, basically.
So the way that politicians make use of economic information, like a lamppost, you say.
Yep.
Obviously, lampposts could provide two things, but they seem to use one of those attributes more than the other.
Yeah, exactly. What I call in the book the lamppost theory of economic policy is that politicians use economics the way a drunk uses a lamppost for support, not for illumination. And what I mean by that is they do like, it's kind of curious, to trot out economists to speak favorably to kosher, if you like, this is Passover, their preconceived policy positions. And they don't really look to economics much for illumination, like what are the facts, what's a reasonable position on this or that issue, even if it's a complex one.
So how should, I mean, in a perfect world, in a world designed by Alan Blinder anyway, how would politicians be making use of economists?
Well, I think they would take more illumination. So what I mean by that is consult more with expert opinion, understand the arguments pro and con. And then, by the way, even if Alan Blinder ruled the world, which is a fanciful thought, not necessarily follow the recommendations of their economists, who, for the most part, are not that astute politically. They might want to deviate from them. But to me, the important thing is to understand what the arguments are and what the economic costs might be if you deviate from, let's just call it, the straight and narrow in a political direction.
So, wow, the jargon is different. The time horizons are different. The needs are different, basically, for economists and politicians. This is a hard breach to seal up, isn't it?
It's very hard. I'm making a stab in this book, but I don't delude myself that I'm going to succeed 100%.
We'll go further into some of the details of the stabs at patching the breach. The book is called Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Alan Blinder is the author and our guest. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Alan and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking about politics and economics and when they get together, which is really a collision in the eyes of Alan Blinder, who is an economist who has worked in some key political positions, for example, on Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He was also vice chair at the Federal Reserve Board. He's written a book about the ways in which politics and economics do collide. His book is called Advice and Dissent. You can join the conversation on the exchange about how we get these two camps to work a little better together. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking about the ways in which politicians do trot out their economists to say, or say that, you know, this is what my economist says I should do. There's a great story on page 3 of George Stigler going off message. What did he wander off the message on?
George Stigler was at the time, he's now deceased, a very famous, extremely prominent, very conservative economist at the University of Chicago. And the Reagan team trotted him out in front of the cameras to sprinkle holy water, they thought, on the supply-side economics theory, which was the theory of the day. By the way, that's where you started this interview. That was the idea that you could cut taxes and yet get more revenue, because there would be so much growth unleashed by the tax cuts. This did not start with Trump. It started with Reagan. Anyway, Stigler got in front of all of these cameras at the White House. I think it was in the White House briefing room, and he said something like, supply-side economics is something between a gimmick and a joke or something like that. Anyway, he basically called it a gimmick, which was not exactly what the White House handlers had in mind when they put him up on stage.
Well, you marvel, as do I, about the durability, though, of supply-side economics. I mean, yep. By this point, there must be millions of bumper stickers around the country saying trickle-down doesn't work, and lots of politicians, Democratic, and I think even some Republican, who say it doesn't work. And yet, it got trotted out again last fall as the reason for passing what was supposed to be tax reform and became more tax cut than that.
Yes. No, it's totally amazing. And, you know, I hate to say this, but that can only have happened in an atmosphere of real ignorance about economics. I think I make the analogy in the book that's as if a politician advocating irrigation in some arid area said he could make water flow uphill without any power. Everybody would laugh at him. Say, we know you can't do that. You need at least power to push it uphill. But we don't have that same kind of... So that's elementary physics. We don't seem to have that level of elementary economic understanding in the electorate.
Now, I want to be clear here. You're not saying that economists are all-knowing, and
no.
At the same time, you're also saying that politicians really can't adopt economic advice wholesale, can they?
Absolutely not. I'll give you one example. We economists often focus on the very long-run equilibrium state, so that sounds like gibberish. After you change the tax code, lots of people do lots of things to rearrange their lives and their businesses, and eventually it settles down with a new tax code. After you have a big trade agreement, some industries expand, some industries contract, and so on, and it takes a while to settle down, and on like that. We economists tend to focus, and almost exclusively sometimes, and that's our mistake, on the eventual equilibrium state. Everything will eventually be fine, don't worry. But if it takes 5-10 years to get there, it's not irrational for ordinary people to worry about what's going to happen to them. What's going to happen to the value of my house? What's going to happen to my job? And so on. Politicians understand that. And too often economists don't. Or don't. I guess the right way to put it is don't pay attention to it. We do understand it, of course. But sort of say, well, you used the phrase before, rounding error. Well, this is a detail. We don't get hung up on the details.
So,
and we should get hung up on the details more.
So in focusing on this five-year potentially event horizon, that's getting into 2.5 election cycles, which for a politician can be several chances to be defeated.
You bet, exactly. And they understand. And you don't have to explain that to any politician. They understand that really, really well. And for that reason, if something is going to cause, you know, I just make up numbers, 3 years of pain, and after 6 years everything will be great, that's not very appealing to a politician.
No, and the people that they serve are generally not going to, particularly if they're having some real pain in their own personal lives, or, you know, can't really hang on to, well, things will be great in 2 years.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And that's an example of one of the reasons why good economic advice has to get tempered by political considerations.
Alan Blinder's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, served as Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors and was a vice chair at the Federal Reserve Board. His book is Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. So we talked about the fact that politicians love slogans and bumper sticker statements and things like that. Economic theories really don't lend themselves to bumper stickers, hats, and tweets, for that matter, do they?
Very, very rarely. Yeah, almost never. You can always find an exception or some, but pretty much never.
All right. Journalists can help, you say. Do they? I guess that's the larger question.
Well, yeah, some do, some don't. So we're on public radio. Public radio is fantastic. Public radio helps a lot. And one of the reasons public radio helps a lot is you can stay with a story for more than 22 seconds. Public television does that also. Economic policies don't lend themselves to 10-second sound bites, but a lot of the media sort of requires that. Second aspect where the media often doesn't help is when a story kind of migrates, so to speak, either figuratively or literally, from the financial pages to the front pages. When that migration, so this is happening with trade right now, for example, when that migration happens, the story moves out of the hands of the financial press and into the hands of the political press, who, first of all, don't understand anything about economics, and secondly, don't care to either. What they want to talk about is the wrestling match aspect, who's on top of whom, who's beating up whom. And, you know, that's okay, but it the economics just gets drowned out.
Mm-hmm. Well, journalists can help, and you pointed out the ways in which they do. I mean, political figures can, too. So can presidents, yep. for example, or not. I mean, is Donald Trump helping people understand the economy better, in your opinion?
Well, you could probably answer that for yourself. No, he's not. Let me just give you one. We could spend hours on that. Let me just give you one example. Donald Trump is trying to sell people on the absurd idea that if we run a trade deficit with any country, and his favorite whipping boys these days are China and Mexico, but we run trade deficits with many countries, something's wrong. Either we screwed up, or we got hornswoggled, or they're beating us, or we're losers, or whatever. This is total nonsense. The whole nature of trade is that there are bilateral deficits and surpluses, bilateral, two parties, all over the place. So I like to give the example of I run a huge trade surplus with Princeton University, which pays me a paycheck every month, and I buy very little from Princeton University. On the other hand, I run a sizable trade deficit with the supermarket in town.
Right.
They buy nothing from me, and I buy a lot from them. Does anybody think that's bad? I mean, it's borderline crazy to think that's bad. That's the nature of trade.
Well, you actually just turned a light bulb on in my head. So the point is not that you run a trade deficit with any country in particular. You'll make it up potentially in surpluses with other countries
because
Princeton University pays you, you pay the grocery store.
Yes, exactly. And that's the way trade goes.
Oh, I can hear the heavens open up.
Yeah. But do you ever hear anything like that out of Donald Trump?
I would say probably not. So let's talk about protectionism. I mean, your thoughts on the tariffs, for example?
Yeah. To most economists, I'll speak for myself, but almost every economist would tell you the same thing. Tariffs are almost always a mistake. They generally, it's like biting off your nose to spite your face, that you're mad at some other country, and so you hurt yourself voluntarily. So in this particular instance, we're going to hurt the steel-using industries. We're going to help, by the way, the steel-producing industry. They're not wrong about that. So Trump did a PR event in the White House. I think he had a bunch of steel workers surrounding him. They were happy about it. They should be happy about it. It's going to be good for them. But there are a very small number of steel workers left in America, and a huge multiple of that are people who work for steel-using companies, construction companies, automobile companies, cans, lots of things use steel. In all those cases, the people that work in the businesses and the owners of the businesses are going to be losers from the steel tariff, which will help the steel industry.
Alan Blinder is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He was a vice chair at the Federal Reserve Board. He served on President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors and is a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton. He is letting us get a look at how things work between politics and economics, and not always very well. The book is called Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Join the conversation on the Exchange. You must have thoughts about how the economic system runs in relation to the political system and vice versa. We'd like to hear your thoughts at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. Steve in Eugene, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Howdy. Question. In the long run, how sustainable is an economy with such a disparity of wealth between the top 1%ers and the bottom?
All right.
And, you know,
all right,
secondly, in terms of economists, what are your thoughts on Paul Krugman?
Okay, so Paul Krugman is number two and sustainability number one.
Yeah, so on sustainability, I'm afraid to say it can be sustained for a fair amount of time. This is as much a political question as it is an economic question. The pure economics is not going to kill either an economy or the rampant inequality. The question is when the political system will say enough is enough. We're seeing too many poor people in a land of plenty, and we should reverse course. This has not happened yet in the United States. We hear a lot about it. There are a number of people, including prominent economists, including prominent politicians, who take the egalitarian side, that this has gone too far already, and we ought to be doing something to reverse it. But as you well know, the majority party in the United States, which these days is the Republican Party, whether you're talking about the Republicans in the House or the Republicans in the Senate or the Republican in the White House, have quite a different view. And what they're in fact doing are things that will increase inequality. So the real question to me is, how long will it take for the political system to reject this this tendency, this trend, which has been going on for a long time, by the way? Inequality has been rising with a couple of interruptions since the late 1970s. By the way, I might add, the interruptions are important. The first interruption was in Bill Clinton's second term, when we had super tight labor markets like we have now, and people got better wage gains, and inequality stopped rising. And the second period was the end of the Obama administration, lopping over to the beginning of the Trump administration, for exactly the same reason, that the labor market got really tight and workers could get better wages. If there's a secret, it's not a secret, to reversing or at least stopping the trend towards rising inequality, that's it. Now, Paul Krugman's a friend of mine. I don't know what you want me to say. More often than not, I agree with him. I guess I don't agree with him on everything. But I'd be surprised, for example, if Paul disagrees with anything I've said on this show so far. Maybe there's something, but there won't be much.
All right, not much space between you then.
Not a lot.
Alan, back to the issue of sustainability, though. So as you point out, the economy can go on for a long time with inequality, but at some point the political system will get disrupted. But as you point out, I mean, the inequality has been rising, but for those two interruptions, since the late 70s. I mean, taxes on people who made a lot of money were relatively high when Ronald Reagan took office. They've been knocked down progressively now to what, the mid-30s in the top marginal rate. And I don't think anybody's talking about going back to Eisenhower-style rates. I see their point that you know, okay, we don't have to pay for World War II anymore, but we got these big deficits and we have a lot of needs.
Yes, we have these big deficits. We have a lot of needs. And we have, this is related to the needs, though it's not the only thing, an aging population, as we all know. We're all aging, but some of us are ahead of the pack on aging. And for many, many years, people said, oh, when the baby boomers start retiring, there are going to be tremendous strains on the budget from Social Security and Medicare. Well, we're well into that now. You might have thought a well-ordered, rational society would have stored in some chestnuts for the winter, but we didn't. Instead, every time we got a chance, we cut taxes, especially on the rich. And now the people born in 1946 are what, let's see, 71 years old, and the baby boom is like the next 15 years of birth cohorts. That's a lot of people either going to retire or already have retired, going on Medicare. That alone in a rational society would, in addition to the preparing it for advance, would say, well, you got to raise taxes a little bit to pay these bills. But we're not doing that. We're, in fact, as you just pointed out, cutting taxes.
Another call here from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alan Blinder.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have a question about how economic policies are viewed ethnically or racially. And my question is twofold, a flip question, is the methods that over centuries people have used to sell economic policies to persons who are actually going to be hurt by those policies, governments or whatever. And then on the reverse, those individuals who perceive themselves as being hurt fractioning away from each other as opposed to a class impact. They say blacks are more, or whites are more, or Native Americans are more. So there's a fractioning instead of a grouping together saying this is impacting us all. We see fractioning out of the bottom in reaction to an economic policy. Thank you.
Yeah, It's a good and a very hard question. I think your point is well taken that one of the elements of success of the right in American politics has been to convince a lot of working class people that the policies that they, the people on the right, favor are going to be good for the working class. This is the trickle-down theory in many manifestations. And, of course, Donald Trump ran on that, exactly on that. And it's a bit of a con game. And if people don't understand economics very well, and if the con artist is persuasive, then the con game can work. An aspect of it, you started your question about how economists view things racially. The answer is not too much. We tend to look at different classes of people by income category, poor, middle class, and rich, more than we do by racial. Not that that is ignored, but as you know, there is a correlation there that black people have less income and wealth on average than white people, a lot less. And so when you talk about policies that are bad for the poor, you're almost certainly talking about policies that are bad for black and Hispanic people as well.
Much more to talk about with Alan Blinder. His book is Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. More phone calls and emails waiting. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Alan Blinder and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Alan Blinder is an economist and a well-sought-after one. He served on President Bill Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, was a vice chair at the Federal Reserve, is now a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton, has written or co-written or co-edited a whole pile of books. His latest one is called Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. And we're talking about the different realities, jargons, and in his view, civilizations of economists and politicians. You can join the conversation on the exchange and talk about your particular gripes about it. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You get into what you call Madison's curse in the book, the checks and balances set up in the Constitution that certainly will slow and frustrate us. That's not all at work here. There are different time horizons we've talked about. 5 years perhaps for an economic policy to take full hold, 2 years or less in most cases to the next election for any politician. But it's not just length of time here we're talking about. There's also the sequencing of events. And you say politicians have this right.
They do have it right. I mean, if you I used the following trivial example in the book. In the year 2010, Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare. Narrowly. Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act narrowly. And then in November of that year, we had an election. And here's the hypothetical. Suppose the votes on those two things were held over till the next Congress in January. What would have happened? Well, of course, this is a really easy political question. They would have failed badly. We wouldn't have either law. In economic thinking, that seems crazy, right? Because the equities of the case, of either case, the healthcare case or the financial reform case, didn't really change very much after November of 2010. I don't think they changed at all, really. And so if you had a bunch of economists voting on these bills, they would have voted more or less the same way before November 2010 or after November 2010. But that, of course, is political nonsense. So the sequencing, the timing, is enormously important in politics.
Well, and also in what is taken up first, because as you pointed out, the Congress that took on Obamacare didn't deal with climate change, and no Congress has since.
That's exactly correct. The timing, there's this old adage, timing is everything. It's a slight exaggeration, but timing is crucially important in politics, because one thing crowds off the agenda, something else that you might want to do, just as you just gave an example of that.
We have an email here from Liz, no town given. She says, while I don't disagree that both political views and economic information need to be balanced by our government and the public, we really need to understand that economics is not a hard science like physics. It relies too much on models that do not represent real human behavior, fails to measure externalities such as environmental impacts, and makes many political value choices of its own as it pretends to be neutral. Liz says we need more emphasis on the political process and less of our current narrow focus on the cost as the major determinant. That again from Liz. What do you think, Alan?
I think there's some truth in what Liz said. I take exception to a couple of things. One is the thing about externalities. So externalities means, that's an economic jargon term, that means effects that some transaction has on some third party that has no say in that transaction. So the quintessential example is pollution. A business may pollute in the atmosphere, and if the government is not intervening, that imposes costs on people that have nothing to do with either working for the business or buying what it sells or anything like that. They're just innocent victims. Economists have been working on that problem for over 100 years, and we never forget about that. It's why economists have been calling for emissions taxes of various sorts for almost 100 years, and nowadays they're almost entirely lined up in favor of a carbon tax as a remedy, not a perfect cure, but an important remedy for climate change. So I don't think we're guilty of that one. The first charge that we sometimes ignore, that I guess I'd put it this way, that we sometimes assume more rationality on the part of people than human behavior actually gives us, is a valid charge. Economics getting a little better on that, but I think that's a fair criticism.
Fair too for her to say it's not a hard science like physics?
Absolutely. I think I have a phrase like that just in the book someplace. It's absolutely right.
So in terms of I always come back to the time window thing where an economist will believe we'll hit equilibrium in 5 years after a policy is enacted, but the politicians don't have that long. But but didn't Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker, when he was the head of the Fed, team up to break inflation in the early 80s and hold on through an election cycle?
Well, team up is an unusual phrase. So what happened is that Paul Volcker was already chair of the Fed when Ronald Reagan became president, and he was fighting inflation very hard. Reagan came in and made it a bit harder. He supported him verbally.
Uh-huh.
So that's the part that you mean. He did support him verbally. But what was happening, not with the mouth, but with the hand, so to speak, is a huge tax cut, which is not what you do if you're trying to fight inflation. The consequence of that was a collision between what we call in the jargon tight monetary policy, so that means high interest rates, and loose fiscal policy, which in this case meant mostly tax cuts. So you're both pulling and pushing the economy at the same time, and what we got was super high interest rates as a result of that. So, you know, I wouldn't quite go with the word team up.
Okay.
On that.
That seems fair. Let's take another call here. It's John in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the economist Alan Blinder. John, you there?
Yes. I would get into political arguments with people, and they would answer, it all boils down to economics. And finally, I went to the library at Humboldt State University. And here's this big wall on economics. And I went to the oldest book I could find on it, which was a book called Progress and Poverty, written by Henry George.
In 1879, I see, yeah.
Yeah. And the basis of our economic policy, according to what he wrote about, was feudalism and how that the wars needed to be fought. The peasants got tired of fighting the wars, so the noble class and the aristocracies would start, the nobles would tax the peasants to hire mercenaries to fight their wars. And it's been going on ever since. In 1913, that's when the income tax was legislated.
Mm-hmm.
There was a political party called the Single Tax Party. And I was wondering if Alan would explain a little bit about the missing link of our economic policy being land holdings.
Right. So the single tax, this was the idea that made Henry George famous. By the way, I might interject just a second. Henry George was a huge believer in and proponent of free trade among nations.
Ah, okay.
So that's a commercial for good economic policy. Let me now answer your question. Henry George believed in the single tax on land. There's a rationale for that, because taxes generally, the term economists like to use, distort behavior. That just means change behavior. Sometimes you actually want that. So we put heavy taxes on cigarettes to try to get people smoking less.
Mm-hmm.
But when we tax work and people work less as a result of that, that's not good. That's not a happy aspect. So that's an example of a tax distortion. And similarly with investment, you tax the returns on investments and people are liable to invest less. Henry George pointed out that, you know, what's this saying that invest in land, they don't make it anymore?
Right.
However we tax land, there won't be either more nor less of it. The size of Oregon is not going to change if the government in Oregon raises or reduces the tax on land. So land is an attractive thing to tax from that point of view. The problem with George's idea was the word single. It's really, land is just not that big a deal in the scheme of things. And so the idea that we could raise all the revenue we need just by taxing land is a pipe dream. I doubt if Henry George came back to Earth now, he wrote this a long time ago,
no.
He would have this, he would seriously entertain the notion that we could raise all the revenue we want by taxing land.
All right. I want to get it before we have to go in about 5 minutes. A look at some of the things that we were talking about with your approach, which is the idea of being hard-headed and soft-hearted. You know, and,
yep.
And we're aware constantly of the fact that people do tend to hang with people like them. So it's no surprise that much of the political class sees things through a rich white guy lens. So being soft-hearted, to use your term, begins with a bit of a disadvantage there, doesn't it?
It does. Well, let me think about it. It does in the context that you were just speaking,
mm-hmm.
Jeffrey. It absolutely does. On the other hand, a good politician should be able to get somewhere with that, because most of the people are not in the upper 1%. In fact, 99% of the people are not in the upper 1%.
By definition, yes.
Yeah, by definition. So I think that in good political hands, the soft-hearted part, which is about fairness and equity and caring for the underdogs in society, ought to be able to get somewhere. Now, I say that, and someone's going to say, well, that's a very nice pipe dream, but look at the current state of American politics, and I can't say that they're wrong.
Mm-hmm. So what do we need to be hard-headed about? What kinds of things would you like to do to increase fairness and equity?
Right. So hard-headedness is about respect for economic efficiency. So along with what I was just saying before, use the tax system in less distorting ways. Use the transfer system in more efficient, less distorting ways. Use markets for most things where markets do a good job, but then intervene in markets where they don't. So that was the externalities point that your caller brought up a few minutes ago as one example.
Mm-hmm.
Don't pursue pipe dreams. You know, I hate to say this as a Democrat, but Bernie Sanders ran in 2016, among other things, on a $15 an hour minimum wage, which may be a wonderful thing in San Francisco or Manhattan, where wages are high. But in Mississippi, the average wage is $18.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to make $15 the minimum? It really doesn't make sense to do things like that.
When we talked about the transfer system being more efficient, you mean talking about things like Social Security, where you're transferring essentially money from people working now to people not?
Yes, Social Security, unemployment insurance, food stamps. We don't call it food stamps any longer. It's called SNAP.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody still calls it food stamps. all those things. Those are things that we use, though not as much as European countries, to redistribute income towards the poor and near poor, and we ought to be making those as efficient as we can.
Through what process? I mean, what is inefficient now, I guess, is the
big... make them less distortionary. So, for example, we as a society have made this a little better now, but some of these programs have embedded in them implicit tax rates, that is, the loss of benefits as your income goes up, that approach 100%. That's a very bad idea, because then you kill all incentive to work.
Alan, you say there was a case where hard head and soft heart did work in 1962. What was that?
1962 was the year, I think, that Milton Friedman published this book, Capitalism and Freedom. Milton Friedman, of course, was a very, very conservative economist, but this is coming right back to the question you were just asking me about. He advocated, instead of the current welfare system, circa 1962, which did have over 100% implicit tax rates in it, what he labeled a negative income tax. And it was exactly to get away from that, to move to a system. So the word negative tax is, in your income got low enough, instead of you paying into the government paid to you.
Is this the basic idea of guaranteed basic income now?
Sort of like that. Yeah, something like that. But what I was going to say, it's very close, actually, to what we now call the earned income tax credit and to food stamps.
Oh.
People's food stamps go down as their income goes up, but the implicit tax rate is nowhere near 100%.
All right. There's so much in the book that we didn't get to, and it's really worth a read. Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Alan Blinder, the author of the book. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.